if that continues, that kind of thing continues, it's probably going to force the hand of the authorities.
Protests and clashes continue in Hong Kong. It's Monday, July 22nd. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. You'll find us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, dry and wet in Australia. Pakistan's Prime Minister is in Washington. China and Vietnam at odds. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Hong Kong riot police fired tear gas and rubber bullets late Sunday to disperse pro-democracy protesters who again filled the streets of the Chinese territory. Tens of thousands of demonstrators protested for the seventh straight weekend, with some defacing the Chinese national emblem on Beijing's liaison office, some threw eggs at the building, and spray-painted surrounding security cameras. Acrid clouds of tear gas enveloped the territory's dense commercial district. The protests have morphed from a call for an end to the now-suspended bill to extradite Hong Kong residents charged with criminal offenses to China for trial into demonstrations for democratic reforms and an end to Beijing's tighter grip on the territory. It is the worst social turmoil to rock the former British colony since it returned to Chinese rule 22 years ago. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Andrew Scobell, senior political scientist with the RAND Corporation, and he asked him how long these protests could go on.
Well, I guess there are three sides. The protesters, the Hong Kong authorities, and then Beijing, the national authorities in the capital, Beijing. And none of those three parties seem amenable to compromise or de-escalation. And so how long can this go on? It could go on for more weeks, but with the events that took place this Sunday, if that kind of thing continues, it's probably going to force the hand of the authorities.
Why do you think it has gone on so long, and why do you think that the scope of the protest has expanded as it has?
One of the reasons why the protests have gone on so long, I think, is because the protesters are made up of a variety of groups that have different priorities, different demands, and it's hard to get unity and cohesion. That means that individual groups can organize protests, and then they can snowball. So it's very hard for any individual or group to organize or coordinate the protests, which makes it much more volatile, much more difficult to control. The other important reason why the protests have not slowed down or ended is because there hasn't been a acceptable or response from the authorities, whether that's the local authorities in Hong Kong or from Beijing. Of course, the one important meeting of the protesters' demands was the pulling of the extradition law, which was significant. Beyond that, there hasn't really been a clear response, and so it's both frustrated and emboldened the protesters.
What do the protesters really want? What could end these protests?
To be fair to Chief Executive Carrie Lam and the Hong Kong authorities, they're really in a very difficult situation because they're under pressure, obviously, from the protesters, but they're also under pressure from Beijing to get restore order, restore stability in Hong Kong. And responding to those different pressures, I wouldn't wish on anyone.
Is everything being synchronized in these protests by social media? Is everything, or is there some kind of outside, the possibility of some kind of outside force that is taking hold of at least part of these protests?
To the best of my knowledge, these are very self-directed and driven from by Hong Kong, different groups within Hong Kong. What is also important is the perception in Beijing that there are outside forces exerting influence or manipulating or inciting these things and these events, and that makes for a great deal of paranoia and alarm if on the part of Chinese leaders, which does not augur well, I think, for the future of Hong Kong.
Andrew Scobell, senior political scientist with the RAND Corporation, speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. Japan's ruling coalition secures upper house majority. Hong Kong police fire tear gas to disperse protesters. U.S. advisor Bolton travels to Japan, South Korea amid trade dispute. You'll find all these stories and much more when you visit our Facebook page at VOA Asia, as well as the voanews.com website. We continue with VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. As drought-hit towns across New South Wales and Queensland edge closer to completely running out of water, federal and state governments in Australia are trying to come up with ways to guarantee supplies into the future. But on the other side of the continent, the city of Perth is leagues ahead in its water efficiency following a long-term decline in rainfall. Part of its survival plan relies on recycled water from toilets, a move that many consumers elsewhere still consider to be unpalatable. From Sydney, Phil Mercer has details.
Since 2017, residents in the Western Australian city of Perth have been drinking water recycled from sewage. It's filtered using a process called reverse osmosis, which is similar to forcing water through a giant sponge. It's then disinfected with ultraviolet light at a treatment plant, pumped into natural aquifers and extracted. Perth is a city of 2 million people, and Claire Lugar from Western Australia's Water Corporation says it's had to get used to climatic changes.
We know from the mid-70s onwards, Perth's rainfall has been declining by about 20%, and that's had a huge impact on our water sources that are dependent on the climate.
Lugar says convincing residents of the benefits of drinking recycled sewage did take time.
So it's only a small percentage of the water that comes into the plant that's actually from our toilets, but getting over that perception, that kind of image that you might be drinking the water that you're flushing down the toilet, that was probably one of our big challenges initially.
Two desalination plants supply about half of Perth's water. Aquifers are also crucial, but recycling produces only 2% of the total. But that figure is soon expected to rise. Ian Wright, an expert in environmental science at Western Sydney University, believes other parts of Australia should embrace recycling.
In Sydney, that's probably 150 litres per day per person of wastewater that's completely wasted. And yes, we have the availability of desalination on the coast, but Canberra doesn't have desalination. And then the poor drought-stricken towns like Tamworth and Dubbo and Broken Hill, they could really, really use that now.
More than 95% of New South Wales, Australia's most populous state, is officially in drought, and the next 3 months are forecast to be drier than average. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan will meet with U.S. President Donald Trump later today at the White House. VOA's Aman Azhar spoke to experts and Pakistani residents in the United States about their expectations for the visit and filed this report narrated by Bejan Hamdard.
Since he took office in 2017, President Donald Trump has been critical of Pakistan's alliance with the United States, blaming it for failing to effectively counter extremist groups.
We're supporting Pakistan. We're giving them $1.3 billion a year, which we don't give them anymore, by the way. I ended it because they don't do anything for us. They don't do a damn thing for us.
Under Trump, the Pentagon canceled hundreds of millions of dollars in military aid to Pakistan, accusing Islamabad of giving material aid to insurgents, which Pakistan denies. Now, with the U.S. peace talks with the Afghan Taliban reportedly making headway, former U.S. ambassador to Pakistan Richard Olson says there is room for growth when it comes to bilateral ties.
I think this reflects a gradual improvement in relations between the United States and Pakistan. It's difficult to imagine this trip having taken place, say, a year ago. And I think what has changed is that there is an appreciation in Washington now that Pakistan has been very helpful on delivering peace and a political settlement in Afghanistan.
Olson also thinks the two leaders may be able to build on what they have in common.
There are certain parallels between the two individuals. They're both sort of right of center in their political contexts. Both of them have an ability actually to appeal to the religious elements of the right of center, even though they're perhaps not themselves personally religious figures. They have, of course, they've both been celebrities and had colorful personal lives. What the dynamic will be between them, I can't say. I don't think anyone can predict that.
This is Khan's first trip to the United States since becoming prime minister, leading some Pakistani Americans to hope that it could lead to a breakthrough after years of tension.
Pakistani diaspora want to see Prime Minister Khan's visit with President Trump and other government officials as a starting point. They are hoping that this vehicle continues and does not stop here, and a constructive relationship between the two leaders are built.
The Pakistani community in the U.S. is very happy for his trip to the U.S. because this can lead to an economic reform, which is really good for the country and the nation.
You know the current situation in Pakistan, and every person is hoping that Imran Khan will do something that hasn't been done yet.
The meeting raising hope the two leaders can make some headway on a peace deal in Afghanistan. For Aman Azhar, Bejan Hamdard, VOA News.
Coming up, a centuries-old spat continues. You're listening to VOA Asia. This news from VOA Asia, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's ruling coalition secured a majority in Japan's upper house of parliament in election Sunday, according to vote counts by public television and other media. Exit polls indicated Abe could even close in on the supermajority needed to propose constitutional revisions. You can visit VOA Asia Facebook for more on this and other stories. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, China and Vietnam are continuing to clash over a maritime sovereignty dispute, despite diplomacy and calm being displayed by other claimants to the same area. The communist neighbors talk regularly about their differences, party to party, as well as through diplomatic channels. Yet, a new dispute erupts between China and Vietnam about once a year. They're locked in another new one now over energy exploration in an area in the sea that both countries call their own. Eduardo Arural is associate professor at the National University of Singapore's Public Policy School.
I think the big picture on China-Vietnam relations is that they would go for diplomacy and they would go for hardball games. It's a very long love-hate relation between China and Vietnam.
In the most recent clash between the two countries, a Chinese Coast Guard vessel has been patrolling since June 16th around a seabed tract about 352 kilometers off the coast of southeastern Vietnam. Our thanks to Ralph Jennings, who is following the story in Taipei. You've been listening to VOA Asia. Perhaps you were hearing us online via iTunes or SoundCloud, or maybe on Facebook. You can catch us every day on VOA Asia Facebook. For our listeners in Myanmar, you can hear us on Facebook VOA Burmese. We thank everyone there who has listened to our program today. We thank our director, Tracy Carter, engineer Zainab Abdel-Rahman, our managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead.